Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke, along with travel expert Rick Steves, recently back from Cuba. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Not easy to do, by the way, going to Cuba, I understand.
A lot easier now than it was a year ago.
Getting easier. In a few minutes, Rick, will you tell us how to do it and what Cuba was like for you?
I can hardly wait.
Excellent. That's in about 10 minutes. And then later in the show, we'll ask about how Europe's refugee crisis affects travel there and even how apples taste in Europe versus Washington State. But we begin this hour with workers' rights in Seattle. A $15 minimum wage is already on the way, and now the people who led that campaign have a new mission: secure scheduling. Workers complain that irregular schedules can wreck their lives, and the advocacy group Working Washington wants the Seattle City Council to help. Darian Showquest works at a Starbucks in Seattle's Mount Baker neighborhood. His mother worked at the Starbucks on Broadway in Capitol Hill. He's one of the workers calling for change today, and he told us what it looks like when workers have these irregular schedules.
I've seen it with my coworkers who are students, having to choose between taking a class or working a shift that pays for that class. I've seen so many mothers just scrambling for childcare, whether it be from a service or from their friends and their families, because they can't put a consistent system in place when some Thursdays they're closing and some Thursdays they're opening, and they don't know when they'll need it. So it's always grasping for this at the last second. And even just generally, being able to look farther than tomorrow is difficult when you don't know what you'll be working tomorrow.
Well, when this issue came up last year, Starbucks responded by promising to post schedules a week in advance and to schedule at least 8 hours between shifts. Why has that not been good enough?
And it was a very hopeful comment, and it was promising. The biggest reason that it didn't come to fruition, the biggest reason we didn't see it in every store in the country, was because there wasn't really a concrete plan. There wasn't really an active movement to listen to what was happening and try and fix it. It was more to the point of Starbucks corporate saying, I believe, quote, managers need to go the extra mile in the message they sent out, which is really just saying, you guys are working really hard on the limited labor budget we're giving you. You guys are already very stressed out by constantly having to fill holes, but we need you to work harder. You know, and rather than accommodating management, they really just asked more of them. And naturally, people who are already, you know, under immense pressure and stress already couldn't always accommodate. They couldn't always, you know, fix the holes. And it's why we still saw clopenings happen even after the pledge.
Explain clopening, by the way.
Oh, clopening.
You haven't had the pleasure yet. What is clopening?
Yeah, it's a fun term. All the kids are using it. It's when you close the store, whether you close at 8:30, 9:30, 10:30, and you are opening the store the next morning, anywhere from 4 a.m. to 4:30 to, you know, 5 a.m.
Bleary-eyed.
Yeah, bleary-eyed.
Darian, you knew this job had an irregular schedule when you took it. Your mom worked at Starbucks. Why not get a job that's got a fixed schedule?
Well, I really wanted to work at Starbucks, you know, first and foremost. I applied to a few places thinking, you know, whichever is fine, but I'd really like to work there. And so far, I've actually really enjoyed it. I knew that there would be inconsistency. Like, I knew I wouldn't get weekends. You know, I wouldn't have a 9-to-5. And I was content with that. What I didn't realize was that it would demand much more of my time than initially promised. What I didn't anticipate was that oftentimes the promises made to us as employees, that the hours we're going to get consistently, the days that we're going to get consistently, were just that. They were just promises.
Well, why not let companies like Starbucks hire people who are okay with an irregular schedule like that?
Well, I think at the end of the day, having inconsistent and endlessly demanding schedules, it limits, you know, your free time, your ability to plan. Ultimately, it limits your upwards mobility. Like, there will always be people who are working these jobs. There are. You know, I'm working them. I have coworkers, you know, who are students, who are mothers, who are community leaders, who are working these jobs because, you know, they need to and they have to. So, you know, they don't need to hire anyone else. Like, the people who need these jobs are working them. The reason it needs to be addressed isn't because there's a lack of people who will work these jobs. It's looking at what we're doing to the people working these jobs.
Okay, so you're asking the city council to make changes. You had city council members Gonzalez and Herbold with you at your news conference. What's the law you and they want to see?
What we would like to see, legislation that would allow access to hours before new employees are hired. If you were promised 40 hours a week and you're only getting 15, if new people are going to be hired, the hours that would go to them or to hiring new people in general would first be, diverted to the people who need them, who were promised them. It would be to end clopening because, honestly, people need sleep. We do. For no other reason that we cannot function properly without it. It affects our mental health. It affects our, how our bodies function, our diet. We need to sleep, and so we would try to end clopening. Also, having your schedule just 2 weeks in advance, at the very least, because if you can't plan a week from today, 2 weeks from today, how are you going to plan the rest of your life?
Darian Schoquist works at a Starbucks in Seattle's Mount Baker neighborhood. We reached out to Starbucks to comment on this story. We haven't heard back from them yet. It's, of course, not just about Starbucks. These workers want more regular scheduling at fast food restaurants, clothes retailers, other retail stores. You're listening to KUOW Seattle. Good afternoon. I'm Bill Radke. Tacoma teacher Nate Gibbs Bowling was at a conference when he sat down next to a teacher from Baltimore.
And she's been teaching for 17 years and has never had a white student. That's insane to me. The segregation in schools is so stark that she's been teaching for 17 years and has never had a white student.
Around that time, Nate was also seeing photos from Detroit schools, students sitting next to buckets collecting water from a leaky ceiling. All of this made Nate angry. So he sat down and wrote about school segregation and how teachers can stop it. That blog post, titled "The Conversation I'm Tired of Not Having," hit a nerve among teachers across the country. I asked Nate, what does segregation look like in Washington State?
Well, I live in the city of Tacoma, and the city of Tacoma is, I believe, about 65% white, and I teach at a high school that's 27% white. And so it happens here. If you walk the hallways of schools in South Seattle, they look very different than the hallways in schools in North Seattle.
Why do you say in your post that white America is basically happy with segregated schools?
It seems that they are. White America is happy with segregated neighborhoods as well. Essentially, our schools are neighborhood schools, so we have segregated schools because we have segregated neighborhoods. Essentially, what I see happening is there are a large number of white Americans, and I'm not calling them racist. I'm just saying that this is the reality. There's a large number of white Americans who are very comfortable not living around people of color.
How could we change that situation?
I'm not sure there is a way to change the situation with segregated housing that society is going to be willing to accept, but there are ways to change the same situation with segregated schools. Integration and busing worked, and we dismantled the working system.
You say that our worst schools need our best teachers.
Absolutely.
You're teaching advanced placement classes. What are you doing to get to the kids most in need?
So teaching is relational. I build a relationship with my students, and I show them that I value them. And then once I've sold them on me, the teacher, then I sell them on the content. I'm teaching government right now, but with the relationships I have with the students, tomorrow I could walk in and say, hey, I'm going to teach you all algebra, or hey, I'm going to teach you all chemistry. And like, I believe fundamentally, because of the relationships I've built with students, that we could get through it together. Teaching is relational.
How do you do that?
You have to value the students. You have to show them who you are and show that you care who they are and that you value the experiences and where they come from. Personally, for me, it's easier. I grew up a mile and a half from the school. I live in the neighborhood that I teach. So for me, I often think about, it sounds funny to say this, but like counterinsurgency doctrine. When you're doing counterinsurgency work, you win hearts first and then minds.
You wrote in your blog post, if you ain't talking about the teacher in the classroom, I ain't listening. What do you mean by that?
There's a ton of educational issues that are going back and forth, fights over charters, fights over standards, fights over valuations. But the most important factor affecting student achievement within the school is the quality of the teacher in the classroom. And so if we're not having a conversation about the quality of the teacher in the classroom, then I'm really not interested in it.
Well, one way of measuring the quality of a teacher is a standardized test. What's a better way of measuring or assessing a teacher's quality?
One of the things I'm really fond of is student perception surveys. Students sit through instruction day after day, period after period. Students know what good teaching looks like and what bad teaching looks like. I'm not a big fan of using standardized tests as a measure of teacher effectiveness. I think there's much better ways of doing it. I think peer observations are a good idea. And one thing I would say is that the evaluation system we have today in schools is very, very time-consuming. And so if we want to have really effective and really meaningful evaluations, we have to put more administrators in the building because, like, take my school, for example. We have 80 teachers, and we have 4 administrators. So that means every administrator is evaluating 20 teachers. Like, that's hard work. And so what we need is we need to have an evaluation system that is doable for principals, that includes feedback from students, and also in some places they've piloted peer-to-peer evaluations. I would love to work in a system in which I was able to go in and watch my peers work and have my peers watch me work.
You said that you find yourself tuning out of these big policy conversations about education. What are you going to do differently to address the racial and economic differences in the U.S. education system?
Well, one of the things that I would say is that I don't have the power to change a lot of minds. So I guess the thing for me is if so much the racial politics in the United States are like the gun control debate, it's intransigent. Like, nothing is going to change. And so I'm not saying that conversations about Common Core don't matter, and I'm not saying conversations about charters don't matter. I'm saying that the only thing that I know how to do is teach, and that I'm going to put my effort and my energy into affecting policies that keep the best teachers in the classroom and give them our most needy schools.
Nate Gibbs Bowling is the 2016 Washington State Teacher of the Year, and he wrote that blog post that's gone all over the place called "The Conversation I'm Tired of Not Having." He teaches AP Government and Human Geography, Lincoln High School in Tacoma. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Good afternoon. Cuba is coming closer and closer to you as the White House keeps easing up on travel restrictions. Is it about time for you to go? And what will you find in Cuba? Let's ask the host of Travel with Rick Steves, who's in his office in Edmonds. Rick Steves, buenas tardes.
Buenas tardes. Nice to be with you, Bill.
And you are, as I said, back from a trip to Cuba. We'll talk about logistics in a moment, but what struck you about your visit?
What struck me about my visit is what a adventure it is, what a mystery it is for Americans, and how casual it is for Europeans and Canadians. You know, Cuba is the number one Caribbean destination, and it has been for years for Canadians and Europeans and other Latin Americans. But for Americans, it's kind of like the forbidden fruit. But now things are loosening up, and I wanted to go, and to go just as a typical traveler, and go wide open with our government, knowing I was doing it, claiming to be professional research. I went with my daughter, who's a school teacher, and she got her, you need to have a general license, and it's one of 12 different acceptable categories, and professional research is a nice one for a teacher to claim. And right. Then we just flew in and had the time of our life. It was an amazing experience.
Yeah, you have to be a professional researcher or a student you have to have relatives there or a journalist. I mean, it's not free and easy to go to Cuba yet.
Well, it's breaking apart now. And my feeling is there are these little technical hurdles, but our government is quickly getting to the point where they're realizing, you know, we can't stop this flood of interest in Cuba. I did not fly from the United States. I flew through Mexico. But you can't give any money to Cuba for a deposit or a flight. So I bought my, you know, I flew to Mexico City as if I was going to Mexico. And then from Mexico City to Havana, I bought my ticket on Aeromexico through London. And I can give money to London, even if I'm flying to Cuba. See, we have this embargo where you cannot, you know, send money to Cuba from the United States, the way I understand it now. And you can't use your credit card in Cuba. So you got to go in with all your hard cash. And then you change your hard cash into convertible pesos when you get there, which is really easy. We arranged our bed and breakfasts through Airbnb-type services, but we had to do it through Canada. But every time we got online to give some money to go to Cuba, an American government drop came under the computer screen, and we had to affirm that we have a general license, and I'm going under this category. So I had to be consistent about that. And then we went over there and we celebrated New Year's in Cuba, and I flew back through Mexico City, and I got to Houston, and I said, "Hey, I was just in Cuba. I've got souvenirs. Don't you care?" And they said, "Welcome home." So it's and the other Americans are having the same kind of experiences. I've had a lot of people from my staff here at Rick Steves Europe, and we're going to Cuba just for fun, and it's quite an exciting place to go. And there's this sense that it's on the cusp of huge change. And I've seen humble Latin American cultures and economies being overrun by Dunkin' Donuts and Wendy's and Burger King's. And that's about to happen in Cuba, I'm afraid. So a lot of people get that sense, and they want to see this amazing time warp of Cuba before that change sweeps in.
What is that amazing time warp like right now? You were just there. Paint a picture for us.
Well, I was just there right now, and one of the highlights for me, Bill, was just walking down the streets of Cuba where people live. And two blocks from the Capitol building, which is modeled after our Capitol building, you find yourself in these colorful barrios with, not desperate poverty, but poverty with dignified people living in rundown buildings. And it just felt to me like a melting sugar cube painted in all sorts of pastels in a 1950s time warp. And just, you know, people roasting pigs on spits and makeshift grills out in front of their high-rise tenements and classic 1955 Dodge cars rumbling down the street. Every time I got in a car, the owner would say very proudly, "This is 1955 American." And I said, "Me too. I was born in 1955. And all the cars were from 1955, except for the Russian Ladas, which are the tin cans from the Soviet Union that were brought in, you know, back in the 70s. But just everything was surprising. Everything was friendly. Everything was affordable.
Well, Rick, you mentioned so many things that can be charming to us, but did you get a sense of what the spirit, you also mentioned poverty. Like, what's the spirit like there today?
Well, you know, I like to go to countries that are a little bit edgy, and I've been in Palestine and Iran and Egypt and Russia and different places like that recently, and I try to get a sense of the political pulse, you know, and as an American there, I didn't know how I'd be received, and I was received warmly. The only anti-Americanism I felt was they were upset with the embargo, which was keeping them, in their mind, in their vision, impoverished. You know, they were loyal to their revolution, the people who stayed in Cuba. They're not loyal to the system right now that they think is not working, and they've all got all sorts of complaints about their government. But fundamentally, they want to be independent and free. They don't want to be owned by foreign corporations, and there's that spirit there. I think a lot of Americans would compare Cuba to the United States and say it's an economic basket case, but that's not fair. I think it's best to compare Cuba with other impoverished Latin American countries that happen to be capitalist instead of communist. And then you realize that the people on both sides, with both economies, are equally poor. The difference is, I found in Cuba, that they were educated, they had health care, they had a sense of dignity and pride, and it was safe. I've been frankly scared to death on the streets of San Salvador and Managua walking around after dark. You're reckless as a first world traveler not to get in a taxi to go from your hotel to a fancy restaurant in those cities. But in Cuba, you could walk through the poor neighborhoods at midnight and feel very, very safe.
Rick Steves hosts Travel with Rick Steves Sundays at 8 p.m. here on KUOW. He's got a Facebook series about Cuba that I've been looking at, and you can see, Rick, you're going to talk about your recent trip on Sunday, this Sunday, February 7th, at the Edmonds Center for the Arts. Right?
Yeah, Bill, that class is almost full. There's still a few seats left. It's free. So we've opened up another class Saturday at 10 o'clock, Saturday morning, this Saturday, at the Edmonds Theater. But people can sign up for either of those classes at ricksteves.com. Or, as you mentioned, go to Facebook and look at Rick Steves, and I've got 30 posts coming up sharing what I learned and my beautiful trip earlier this month to Cuba.
Rick, will you talk about traveling to Europe amid their immigration crisis with us here in a few minutes?
Be happy to.
Excellent. 20 minutes away, so stay tuned to KUOW's The Record. It's KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Look at your hands. What do you love about them? What do you do with them? Hold an ice cream cone? Drive your car? Scroll through Facebook? What if all of those things caused you severe pain? That's the case for the woman you're about to meet. Her daughter, Radioactive Youth Media's Sheena Williams, has always seen her mom as strong.
My mom is a very headstrong woman.
What do you mean strong?
Ma, strong as in willpower, independence.
Ah, independent? Yeah, I am. I try the best to be dependent, because just only me and my children. If I'm not independent, how I can support my kid? I need to be strong of them.
My mom, Berlina Leonardo, is the only adult in my life that was always there. She was born in the Philippines and immigrated here in 1993. She is a single mother who raised me and my brother Sean while at the same time helping our family in the Philippines. For my mom, work has always been about making sure to support her family. When I was little, my mom worked for many years in factories, building and assembling parts. Yet when she was working, she felt a pain, tingling over her hands.
You said it was because you were overworking yourself. Is that true?
I asked the doctor how I can get this pain, and the doctor said because I'm using my hands a lot.
My mom's first hand surgery was in 2006. She was worried because she felt that nobody would be able to take care of her after the surgery. She said she felt lonely.
And not happy.
Why?
Because I don't have family in the United States, just only me and my two children. If I was sick, no one they can help me.
I was surprised to hear her say that she needed help from other people, because I've always seen her intimidate others and be aggressive. In 2008, she got another surgery for her broken wrist. I was 8 or 9 at the time. It happened when she was putting up a decoration inside our house and fell off the ladder. Me and my brother stayed overnight at the hospital with my mom because we really didn't have anywhere to go. I remember her lying there, looking exhausted and in pain. She looked at me with red puffy eyes and asked me, "Are you all right?" I was surprised and touched that she would ask me how I was doing. After all, she was on the hospital bed. After my mom's wrist surgery, she tried to work, but she quit because she was in a lot of pain. In 2014, she was diagnosed with arthritis. Whenever she uses her hands, the pain gets worse. But she needs her hands.
Every time I want to eat, I want to drink, I want to take medicine, I want to brush my hair, I want to change my clothes. If I don't have a hands, how I can do that?
Because of everything that's happened to her, she's scared to work. The last time she was working in a paid job was in 2012. She applied for disability twice and was rejected. But she's afraid to work because working is what injured her.
Nobody knows my body. I know because that's my body. You understand what I mean? It's hard to say in English.
I get what you mean, Ma.
Nobody knows your body better than yourself.
Yes, because I feel.
Even though my mom can't work, she's still able to pay for the rent and utility bills and make sure me and my brother eat every day, all by child support money. My mom's hands are in pain every day. Of course, I feel sad to see her that way. I want to be there for her as long as she needs me. I asked her if I could see her hands.
Man, it looks like it hurts. It's like a dimple, kind of, because you can feel it going in the scar. It's pretty deep. And that one,
your right one.
Her hands look faded and rough, yet her scars stand out. A bright pink color and worn with years of use. It's a mark of remembrance for the pain she constantly feels.
Yeah, that looks kind of scary.
Scared, though.
She's scared. But me and my brother, Sean, still believe our mom is a strong person.
I mean, when you're sick, you're sick. Even the strong people, anyone can be sick, pretty much. It's like, oh, she's just a strong woman who also happens to be sick. And that's pretty much it.
Talking to my mom made me realize that she's just like everybody else. A human with flaws and fears.
If you can't use your hands,
uh-huh,
does that mean you're not strong?
Yes. Yes, I'm not strong because always I feel pain.
I'm not strong because I feel pain. I don't know why those words surprised me, but they did. I never really knew the pain my mom was going through was affecting her so badly. I don't see her as somebody weak, even if she does. And I can't imagine respecting her more than I already do.
We're done?
Okay, we're done.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
For Radioactive, this is Sheena Williams.
And you can see Sheena and her mom online, photos of them at KUOW.org. Radioactive is KUOW's youth program. The story was produced in our fall workshop, and applications are now open for our spring workshop at the Seattle Library's Southwest Branch. Are you age 16 to 18? Do you know someone who is? Apply at KUOW.org/radioactive. The deadline to apply is this Friday. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. You probably know Christine Gregoire as a Washington State governor, our state's second woman governor. Her first time in office was as our state's first woman attorney general back in the early 1990s. She almost didn't run for that position. It was her daughter, Courtney Gregoire, now an elected official herself, who got her mom to pursue a career in politics.
When I first questioned whether I should run for attorney general, I remember thinking to myself after talking it over with Dad, you know, this would be the best thing I could do for you girls, that I should just stay home, that it wasn't right for me, that politics was too ugly. That it would be time-consuming. All those thoughts went through my mind, the results of which is, as you recall, I came home and said, after talking it over with your father, to both you girls, I'm not going to run for attorney general for you. And you abruptly left the table, went up and slammed the door to your bedroom, to which I thought, what is wrong with her? I just did this major sacrifice.
I mean, I'm a 13-year-old girl, so yeah. There's a lot of things that could be wrong.
So I went up and knocked on the door and asked you what was the problem. And your statement to me was, you have always said there's nothing I can't do. There's no glass ceiling for me. And now, Mom, you're saying, if I happen to have two daughters, I can't run for office. To which I said, let me think about this. And it was 1 week later, it was a Sunday, talked it over with Dad again, and turned around and said to both of you, for you, I'm going to run for attorney general. And so you actually are responsible for starting my political career, because I would have said no.
You know, Mom, it's probably one of the clearest memories I have of my childhood, of sitting around that dining room table, that white dining room table, looking in my reflection in the window that I often did too much to adjust my hair, when you decided to announce that for Michelle and I, you would not run for office. And I remember the exact sentence so clearly, because it just was a fallacy to me. I couldn't understand where this was coming from, because, of course, wow, what an opportunity. Why wouldn't you do this? But you said it as for you daughters. And so what ran through my head is, man, my mom has told me over and over again that I have lived my life to ensure that you, as a daughter and not a son, have equal opportunity. You want to be a lawyer, you want to be a doctor, it doesn't matter. You got all the opportunities in the world. But I actually did run through my head going, but I'm going to bear the children because I want to have kids. And it's going to change when I bring kids into the world, that the equation is going to change for what I should do. And so apparently not being able to have verbal response at the time, stomping upstairs and locking my door was the best response as a 12-year-old to tell you that's what I meant. I distinctly remember that night. It's a pretty strong memory and will be for a long time.
So, Court, when you first got elected, what was it like for you to work in politics?
I think my approach to politics is you got to build the relationships to get things done. But I got to admit, on the campaign trail, it was interesting the challenges that you ran into. And a lot of times, those were perfectly honest, were from people of our own sex. Women asking me, when I've got a young baby at home, how I thought I was going to be a good mom if I took this position on. And man, did that sting and make you question why people would think that. Because in my view, by running for office and putting myself out there and showing what I want in life, I am the best role model I could be for my little kids.
And I assume, because the criticism or questioning came from women, it was particularly hard.
It was particularly hard. And sometimes it came from what they thought was a good place. Oh, you're brand new as a mom. You don't yet know all the challenges you'll face. But man, you got enough reasons to question, do you want to be in the political realm? It doesn't help for folks to pose those questions. And I got to be honest and, you know, turn this back to you. It's never going to be the perfect time. to put yourself out there in politics, particularly in this day and age, because of how consuming it can be.
That's Seattle Port Commissioner Courtney Gregoire. She's talking with her mom, former Washington Governor Chris Gregoire, about being a woman in politics. Next, Courtney asked her mom, Chris, what was it like to often be the only woman in the room?
One of the most telling stories I can give you about that is I led the country, as you well know, in the settlement of the tobacco lawsuits. 46 states, $206 billion, largest settlement in the history of the world. We're sitting in a conference room and we're stuffing packages to send to my colleagues around the country to get them to tell us whether they're willing to sign on to the settlement or not. Front page, above the fold, New York Times the following day, identified the four men in the room as attorneys general and who they were and where they served and an unidentified woman. 20 years later, in the celebration of that historic settlement, the New York Times put that same photo up, identified the four, and identified me as the number one negotiator of that. So I've been the only woman in the room for much of my career.
Can you remember the first time, or have you ever, had to tell someone, would you have asked the same thing if I was not a woman?
Oh, absolutely.
So what was the first time that happened?
Well, I could tell you this one experience. It was pretty enlightening. After having had the dinner where I said, for you girls, I was going to run for attorney general, I went out there gung-ho, naive as all get out, had never run. And first debate, get done with the debate, and this elderly gentleman comes up to me, and he's shaking his head, no. And I said, is there something wrong, sir? And he said, tell me again what you're running for. And I said, I'm running for attorney general. Shakes his head no again. And I said, is there a problem? And he said, yeah, women shouldn't be generals. To which I thought, whoa, wait a minute. You know, this is not a military thing, you know? And he goes, doesn't matter. Women shouldn't be generals. So I have had my fair share of questions and assumptions. I hope you don't have to go through all of those experiences as you are in politics. But unfortunately today, I'm sure there's still some of it.
The only one so far is, no, you don't get to give me a makeover just because I'm going to run for office.
There you go. Remember remember when you came with me that first time and they wanted to change my makeup and change my hair and so on? We got in the car and you the first question you asked me is, Mom, does Norm Mailing have to have those kind of questions asked of him? So, Court, you've got two amazing daughters. I'm babysitter-in-chief on mm-hmm. Fridays with Dad. If your daughters, either one of them, Alexa or Audrey, should decide that one day they want to get involved in politics, what would you say to them?
Whew. This does feel differently when they're your own daughters. If one or both of my girls said they wanted to enter politics, first words would be, I'm proud of you. I'm glad you're stepping up to the plate. Now here's a couple words of caution. Keep your sense of humor. Realize this is about what you want to give back. And keep your value system at the end of the day.
Good.
That conversation about what it's like to be a woman in politics was between Seattle Port Commissioner Courtney Gregoire and her mother, Christine Gregoire, former governor of Washington State. You're with KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Europe is struggling to welcome Middle Eastern immigrants and refugees, respect their home cultures, and draw them into European culture. And we hear about that struggle in America, right? You hear about countries closing borders, protests from right-wing Europeans, concentrations of poor, desperate refugees, which can make a traveler ask themselves, number one, how safe is Europe today? Number two, is it ethical to spend your American dollar in tourist-friendly places while people suffer, maybe even under policies you don't like? Well, to help you through that, we have with us the host of Travel with Rick Steves. Hi again, Rick.
Good to be with you, Bill.
How does the refugee crisis affect travel in Europe this year?
Well, you know, that's my beat. That's our focus. This last year, we took 900 groups, about 20,000 Americans around Europe on tours. And I was hosting 100 of our European guides here in Edmonds 2 weeks ago, and I'm concerned about that also. And I asked all my guides who earn their living taking groups around Europe, is there any experience that they had in the last year through this crisis that caused them to feel like there was any risk or danger for their travelers or even inconvenience? And as far as risk and danger, they said no, absolutely not. There's no connection at all between refugees and the safety of a traveler, a typical tourist. As far as inconvenience, a couple of times out of 900 tours, there were a delay because refugees were given the right of way at some congested border crossing, or there was one incident where the channel between France and England was shut down because of a refugee issue. And, you know, I wouldn't factor that into my making my travel dreams come true. So I think Americans have to really be clear. There's no logical reason to consider your safety when it comes to the refugee crisis in Europe. I can understand an American confusing fear and risk and being a little uptight about traveling in regards to terrorism, but the refugee situation is completely different, and it's flat out illogical for anybody to be nervous about going to Europe because of the refugees.
Is it ethical to travel to Europe, say a beautiful Greek island, and you're having the time of your life and spending your money and a couple islands over? It's a desperate situation.
Well, if you're being ethical, if you're actually being ethical, it's exactly as ethical to ignore the refugees and go to Hawaii or west coast of Mexico or anywhere on vacation as it is to go to an island next to where there's desperate refugees. This is a reality. And, you know, I know a lot of Americans can't handle reality, and that's what Orlando's for. But my travelers think of the world as a real place, not La La Land. And one of the beautiful things about travel is you get out there and you better understand the other 96% of humanity. And you realize that half of the human beings on this planet are trying to live on $2 a day. And that puts our economic crisis in perspective. And, you know, I think a lot of people are uncomfortable with the fact that there's desperate people. And if you can't relax with that reality, you know, then you should probably just go to Disneyland. But I think it's an actual benefit. It's a blessing to be able to travel and to talk to refugees. When I'm in Europe, I get a chance to talk to refugees, and I get a chance to be inspired by how Europeans are really welcoming them and struggling with it. It's not easy. But remember, Europe is a continent of 400 or 500 million people, and it's a geriatric continent, and they need to revitalize their workforce. And it's, you know, the headlines make things look really desperate and arguably scary from an American perspective. But Europe needs young workers to revitalize their workforce. And these refugees are just trying to get to Germany, which really, you know, will have a place for them once they assimilate. But as you were talking about in the earlier bit there, the challenge for Europeans is to provide a way for refugees to assimilate rather than to squat in a land that is stable and wealthy and still be Syrian. You need to embrace the local society and the respect for women and pluralism and separation of church and state and separation of mosque and state. And that's the challenge for Europe. And I think it's an exciting thing to see Europe grappling with so compassionately and so pragmatically.
Talking with travel writer Rick Steves. One more question for the moment, Rick. Since we're talking about the ethics of travel, I've heard people say with climate change, we shouldn't even be burning all that jet fuel. Why is travel so important that it's worth that?
Boy, that's a very good question, and that's one I'm struggling with. I'm certainly as guilty as any American of contributing into the carbon into the atmosphere because I'm encouraging people to travel. I wish there was a honest, real way to be carbon neutral in my travels. And if there was, I would build it into my tours so that we all were honest about this. But I haven't found a way. A few years ago, I bought 60,000 trees. They cost like $2 each or something like that. And I was told that six trees produce enough whatever to negate the the carbon that we put into the atmosphere, and that would make us travel in a without a negative footprint. I think that's kind of a feel-good measure. I think we got to have some way so that we can be honest about this and pay the price of this so we can travel.
But, Rick, we have just a minute left, so that's why I want to hear why is it so important to travel? You're so eloquent about that.
Well, this for me, I can be comfortable spending lots of money in an age when there are desperate people trying to feed their family, trying to live on $2 a day, and I can travel in a way that contributes to global warming even, as long as I come back sort of an energized citizen of the planet. And I go into the voting booth and I recognize that what really matters is not what makes me and my loved ones better off, but what makes this world a more compassionate and equitable and just and sustainable place. And for that alone, I think travel is a good investment. I want to mention I had a great talk with tour guides from Turkey, Greece, and Sweden talking about this refugee issue, and it'll be featured on our show right on KUOW on Travel with Rick Steves coming up on February 21st. That's Sunday night at 8 o'clock during the regular airing of our travel show on KUOW.
Rick, will you stay a few more minutes and consider apples here and abroad?
I love apples. Let's talk apples.
Let's talk. This is Rick Steves, whose travel program airs Sundays at 8 here on KUOW. So in Washington State, you know, we grow one apple more than any others, and that is the Red Delicious. Marketing is huge in the apple industry, and there are researchers at Washington State University also developing, breeding. They've spent 20 years to try to come up with a better-tasting apple, and they have this new breed now called Cosmic Crisp. It'll be grown exclusively in Washington State. Researcher Kate Evans helped develop it, and she says, as you might suspect, there's a reason the word crisp is right in the name.
It has a really nice, fantastic level of crispness combined with a reasonably firm flesh, so it's nice to bite into, gives you a lot of juice, and then it has all of those good flavoral attributes with the sweetness and the tartness that we all like in apple.
How did you breed this new apple?
When you're breeding an apple, it's all about making a cross, so taking Honeycrisp pollen and putting it onto the stigmas of a flower of Enterprise, which is the maternal parent in this case, then waiting for the Enterprise apples to grow and then harvesting them, taking the seeds out. And it's those seeds that are in the apple that are the new potential varieties. So they're all different. And the big job really as a breeder is that you have to then screen through what can be thousands of seeds. They're all different, all unique. And then the job is to try and select the best new potential individual that you can go on and release as a variety. So it incorporates a lot of testing. What is it going to taste like for a consumer if they're trying to eat the fruit in, let's say, August as opposed to May or October?
But taste is so subjective. How do you know when you found the best new apple?
Yeah, taste is certainly subjective. We have a pretty good team here at WSU in the apple breeding team. There are four of us that normally taste everything, and we're pretty good, actually, at kind of covering all of the sorts of palates, you know, people that like sweet, tart, and everything in between. So between us, we're pretty good at picking out the best stuff.
It's got to be crisp, though. It seems like Christmas has overtaken us. We love crisp. Crisp has come to equal good.
Certainly people associate Christmas with apple and the juiciness that comes with a good crisp apple. It's very satisfying.
Why is that, though? You know, how come mushy was okay when I was a kid and that will not fly anymore?
You know, I don't know. I guess consumers have got used to crisper apples. You know, we can store our fruit in better condition, so we expect to have an apple that's firmer and crisper, and some of the mushier ones are just not as acceptable anymore.
Right. It's like mushy means what's wrong with this apple? Old? Is it? And why Cosmic Crisp? That's the name of your new apple. What's cosmic about it?
Well, the name was chosen after a number of different focus groups, and the people at the focus groups were really taken with the appearance of the apple. The cosmic came from the fact that the little white lenticels on the apple, which are common in every apple, but Cosmic Crisp, they really good contrast in color between the whiteness of the lenticel and the dark background appearance. So it reminded people of the stars and the cosmos. And
What is a lenticel?
The lenticel is like a pore in the skin. So in the same way that we have pores in our skin, then apples do as well.
So it's got a cosmic look to it.
It has, yes.
You know, Kate, I like to think of my apple as happening naturally and not as part of this huge breeding program. Aren't you representing Big Apple and crowding out Little Apple?
I wouldn't say that at all. I think that there are certainly a lot of smaller growers that can grow these varieties. And, you know, that is one thing about being able to release the apple in the way that we've done, so that it's not just big apple producers who are going to be able to grow this new variety, but some of the smaller producers can do it as well. So there'll be Cosmic Crisp in roadside stands as well as in the big supermarkets.
When we walk around a grocery store, we are so aware of brands. I mean, I know there's the Gala here and the Braeburn there and the Fuji there. How did that happen that we became so branding aware, marketing aware when it comes to biting into an apple?
I think the thing about an apple is that they are very variable. You know, the differences between the varieties can really be quite big. And so because of that, they are sold by name. When you compare apple to other fruit, it's important to have that name recognition because you have the very different flavor and texture and appearance attributes. And so, you know, typically when you go buy strawberries, for example, you expect your strawberry to be pretty uniform. It looks like a strawberry. But with apple, because we have this big variety out there, then we have to get the name in there. You have to have that recognition. The consumer needs to be able to say, okay, yeah, I know Granny Smith apple, that's that green one, you know. Therefore, they have expectations about that apple. They link the name with the quality attributes of the fruit.
Why do you care so much about apples?
Oh, well, I think apples are one of those kind of iconic fruits, you know, that we've all grown up with. And they're such a sort of integral part of our diet and our heritage. And they're really just a great piece of food, nice fresh fruit, very good for you, and can be really a pleasure to eat.
Kate Evans, Associate Professor with the Fruit Tree Research and Extension Center with Washington State University. She's developed what she says, not surprisingly, is her favorite apple now, Cosmic Crisp. She says her other favorite is whatever she comes up with next. How about you? What's your favorite apple? Rick Steves, travel writer Rick Steves, do you have a favorite?
Oh, I don't have a favorite apple. I've spent a third of my adult life living in Europe, eating and out of the markets there. And I'll tell you, the big thing in Europe is to eat with the seasons and to not choose things according to how good they look, but how natural they are and how flavorful they are. I've heard that in American sort of conventions for fruit and apples, sometimes you barely taste the apple, and it really is driven by how it looks and how it packs and this kind of thing. Europeans are real flexible. They'll eat by the season, and their big trend in Europe now is what's called a zero-kilometer meal. They really like to eat local, and if apples aren't in season, they'll eat something else. The European kind of go with the flow, slow food, kind of organic approach to things.
Yeah, their menus, I would assume, look different, very different from place to place and time to time.
Oh, yeah. They say a smart eater who goes to a good restaurant in Italy can tell what month it is and what region you're in simply by what's on the menu.
Got a favorite European food find?
Oh, my favorite European food find is eating ugly things on toothpicks in tapas bars and washing it down with local wine and sitting right at the bar with the local people who can give me guidance and getting out of my comfort zone. You know, when I'm here in Edmonds, I never go home and feel like a nice ouzo, but when I'm a cultural chameleon, and when I'm in Greece, I go home and I feel like having a nice glass of ouzo as the sun sets. I can't imagine drinking tea here. I just don't get tea here. But in England, a spot of tea feels just right. When I'm in Tuscany, Corposo, a full-bodied red wine, that just hits the spot. And in Prague, it would be a nice lager or pilsner. And in Belgium, it'd be a heavy monk-made beer. So I'm really a big fan of being a cultural chameleon. Drink and eat what people around you are eating and drinking and go with the season.
Maybe try to do that even in Washington State where you can. Rick Steves, Travel with Rick Steves is the show that airs Sunday at 8 on KUOW. This weekend, he'll tell you about his recent Cuba trip in Edmonds Saturday morning at 10. And that's at the Edmonds Theater. And then Sunday evening at 8, you're at Edmonds Center for the Arts, Rick?
Yeah, and Bill, both of those classes are absolutely free. I'm just excited to share what I learned. There'll be about 2 hours of hot out of the rucksack information, and people can sign up for those classes at ricksteves.com.
Rick, good to talk with you. Thank you.
You bet.
Bill Radke here. I'm a Braeburn man, though I'm open to Cosmic Crisp. Tweet us your favorite apple at KUOW. Thanks to producer Amina Alsadi, and thanks for tuning in.